evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Tonight is February 19th, the birthday of my one and only sister. I just had to say that. 2015, now, and we are bringing you episode 47, which begins on August 3rd, 1942. I am Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And you know, Ray, I don't know if you noticed, anything brought it to your mind, but we're back to Heinrich Heim as note taker. And that occurred on August, he came back on August 2nd. Of course, there wasn't anything, we don't have anything on August 2nd. So he's starting for the first time on August 3rd. And you remember last week when we talked about how the translator said that the August 1st text was very disjointed and badly written. And I realize now that that was because Picker, no doubt, had already left, and Heim didn't take over again until the 3rd. So they must have had somebody else trying to do it on that time. And that's what caused me, something caused me, I put this all together, to go and check that, because I remember mentioning several months ago that Picker was going to be doing it for however many months it was. And he wasn't fired or anything, but Heim, the way I recall it, I was going to go back and check that out, but I ran out of time. But Heim was had to go and do something else for a while. You know, he's highly respected amongst in the party there. But and so the Picker took his place, and then when he came back, well, Picker had to leave, and I think Picker enjoyed doing it. And there's been a bad feeling between Picker and Heim. All this time, and Picker has his own notes, and he published them separately, but they also belong to, I guess, in the Bormann notes, so the Bormann manuscripts, so they're a part of the Heim thing, too. But you know what I miss Picker, because I have decided that I like Picker better than Heim. I like the way he puts it together. Remember, we mentioned that for a while there, more and more, we were getting other people who were there, what they had said, and he was explaining what the conversation was about. Now, we're back to none of that. Heim never did that, and he doesn't do it. He's back to his same old way of doing things, which seemed okay until we had Picker there for a while. And I have to say that I think we got a lot more out of Picker's notes. So you can see I put some attention on this
sure.
In the past week. But I think that's very interesting, because we knew that we had a new guy, that he was going to be only there for a while, and he's gone now. That's it with Henry Picker. So we're back to just hearing from Hitler. And I guess, you know, and this also tells us that, once again, as though we needed to know, that Bormann was not controlling this, because if he didn't tell Picker to do it the way Heim had done it, and when Heim came back, he didn't tell Heim to, well, we started doing this and you should do it that way. He didn't interfere at all. He took both styles without any interference. Because I would think, you know, I would be more controlling over it if maybe he didn't have time. If you don't have time, you don't do it. But I'd say, well, you know, I'm reading this, and this is better than this other and whatever. But the idea from the beginning was that it was just going to be Hitler's words. It was going to be the words of the Führer passed on, not revealed for quite, you know, at the time at all, whenever it would be revealed, but it was for the party members, for the National Socialist Party. And this was Hitler's, I think it's good to say that Hitler was concerned about how the party would function and run without him, and was trying to make as much, making things so that everything could carry on without him. And although this wasn't his idea to take these notes, it was Bormann's and some others, but he didn't say yes right away, but he eventually agreed to it for that very reason, that it would help the party and the people who were running things later on. So they were it was just going to be his words, but it really made it more interesting when we heard the words of the other people who were there. I think I enjoyed that very much.
Right.
So Well, anyway, so we're starting on the 3rd, and there's a timeline for that day, which is a convoy to Malta is decimated by the Luftwaffe and U-boats. Well, that sounds good, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now you please take it away.
Okay. 3rd of August, 1942, evening. Bees and ants, intelligence and instinct, weak and strong. Here's one of the most curious things in nature. There's a certain species of ant in which the whole race dies when the queen ant dies. If a queen bee is ill, the whole hive is uneasy. There is another species of ant which cultivates mushrooms on which to raise lice. The ants look after the lice, carry them out into the sunshine, and then back into the mushroom box. Then they make a special brew of them on which the queen ant is constantly fed. The question occurs to me, where does natural instinct end and human reason begin? One must draw distinctions. A bitch has puppies. Bitches get no training, but they all tend their young with uniform efficiency. That is basic instinct, which must not be confused with reason, which takes its decisions according to certain definite facts. The most primitive of instincts to which all forms of life respond are those of feeding and reproduction of the species. In my youth, I had every opportunity to study bees, for my old father was a keen apiarist. Unfortunately, I was frequently so badly stung that I all but died. To be stung by a bee in our family was an ordinary, everyday occurrence. My mother often pulled out as many as 45 or 50 stings from the old gentleman when he returned from clearing the hives. He never protected himself in any way. All he did was to smoke all the time. In other words, a good excuse for another cigar. The weakling has always in history gathered to himself the smallest following. This was the case in Russia. The last czar, who was a man of no personality, had no following. It is the bloodhounds that the people follow. Things are no different in the West. We can only gain our ends by merciless and continual perseverance. That is contrary to the opinion of many of our upper 10,000, who are always the telephone lines, the harbingers of weakness. How often have I heard the objection, with your brutal methods, you will achieve nothing. With any other methods, I would certainly have achieved nothing. The soldier, too, is, for the most part, devoted to the leader who is stern but just. If a man is a real leader, the people will follow him.
Great stuff.
Yeah, pretty basic stuff. He starts off drawing off, kind of drawing a parallel about bees and ants and their survival instincts and drawing on over to the human side where, you know, follow the leader. If a man is a real leader, as he says, that will out. People will know it. They can start to distinguish between a real and a phony one.
Well, yes, and I like that he brings up the idea of survival. Where is that? But he did. And, you know, he understood the primary importance of survival, which a lot of people don't. They think it's more important to be nice or to not get bad publicity or bad press or, you know, make people upset or anything. But Hitler understood the situation that Germany was in. I think this is so forgotten so often, but it does come up all the time in table talk, and he brings it up, and that in 1918, the terrible state that Germany had been brought to by its enemies, and if they didn't clear these enemies out and do something about it, Germany was not going to survive. And, of course, we can see today, we know today from all the 70 years since 1945 that the intention was and is to destroy Germany as a strong nation that Hitler wanted it to be. And so he was right about that. But survival can be brutal, you know. So he uses things like the bees and the ants, which people might say, boy, who wants to have a human society like that? But he does do that because no matter what, they're into survival. Everything in the bee and the ant colony is what's the word? But is everything else is subordinated to survival, and that's what they're all about. And they have survived for millions of years, and I guess they will forever. And that's even though we don't want to live like bees and ants, but we're not. But still, it's that lesson that you have to what it takes to survive. And for Germany, it was the truth, what it takes to survive. And I would say at this point, Germany's survival is very much in question, and what we call Germans are not what I'd like Germans to be at all. But I don't say that they're finished yet, because they've still, as Hitler has said so many times already here too, the race counts for a lot, and you have to remember the race. As long as they keep from race mixing and diluting the race, that you've got some quality there that can weather the storm. That's the way I see it, and that's how I would defend him.
Yeah, and I thought his statement where he says many people objected to and called him, with your brutal methods, you will achieve nothing. And he very, very accurately turns to them and says, hey, with any other methods, I would certainly have achieved nothing. And
yeah.
And that, you know, that means you have to go the way you're going to go and don't look back. Just do what
you
takes.
Have to do what's necessary, and you have to see that it's necessary. There are a lot of people who would rather be nice and then than win. That if their race goes down and dies, well, so what? You know, a lot of people don't even care about that. That's for sure. And so that's not the most important thing. Well, the survival of Germany and Germans was important to Hitler. There's no question about that.
Sure. Move to August the 4th, 1942, midday. Memories of the First War. The lace workers of Belgium, Ypres and Lübeck. When we went into the line in 1916 to the south of Bapaume, the heat was intolerable. As we marched through the streets, there was not a house, not a tree to be seen. Everything had been destroyed, and even the grass had been burnt. It was a veritable wilderness. In the present campaign, I got my greatest surprise when I revisited Arras. In the old days, it was just a mound of earth, and now, fields filled with blossom and waving corn, while on Vimy Ridge, the scars are much as they were, shell holes and all. I believe it is much the same in the Champagne. The soldier has a boundless affection for the ground on which he has shed his blood. If we could arrange the transport, we should have a million people pouring into France to revisit the scenes of their former struggle. Marching along the roads was a misery for us poor old infantrymen. Again and again we were driven off the road by the bloody gunners, and again we had to dive into the swamps to save our skins. All the thanks we got was a torrent of curses. Bloody so-and-so's was the mildest expression hurled at us. My first impression of Ypres was towers so near that I could all but touch them. But the little infantryman in his hole in the ground has a very small field of vision. I shall send our people, who have been given the task of rebuilding Lübeck, to Ypres before they start work. 50 different shades of tiles, from salmon pink through gold to deep violet. The new Ypres is a city out of fairyland. In those days, the girls making lace always sat working outside the houses, surrounded, of course, by a horde of soldiery. But at least they were able to buy and send home genuine Flemish lace and the embroidery of Brabant. If a soldier in France buys chocolate or a pair of stockings for his wife, I agree absolutely with the Reichsmarschall. We did not start the war, and if the French population have got nothing, what the blazes does it matter to us? I wish to goodness we could buy something here, but here there's nothing but mud.
Well, this has been an interesting one. It leaves me with a question. Mm-hmm. What's he talking about in that last two sentences? Is he speaking of their current location? Are they in Ukraine, in the headquarters in Ukraine? Because he says he wishes we could buy something here, but there's nothing but mud. That would fit Ukraine at the time. Because, boy, a couple of number of things I'd like to point out here. Sorry if I've jumped the gun on you, but I'll just do it real quick. Won't take long.
No, okay, it's go right ahead.
When he said that when they were marching through probably France or beyond France or whatever, they had to dive into the swamps because the gunners. And they poured curses at them. The gunners did. Now, what gunners are these? They're marching on the road, and aren't they just in their own territory that's already taken over by them? Or would they be marching along where there's the enemy driving around there too? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I thought about that, and I tried to. Is he talking about his infantrymen walking along and having to get out of the way of mobile troops?
Germans.
Things like this. Was it his own, or was it gunners from airplanes? You know, where the infantry would have to scatter and dive into the swamps. You know, and it was difficult for me to decipher what he's talking about right here. Who are those gunners, as you say?
Well, you know what? It might be their own, because he's saying we poor old infantrymen, and then these gunners were on tanks or whatever the heck, and they're driving along, and they don't want to have to stop or slow down for these infantrymen. So they weren't very nice to him, or, you know, like, come on, you know, you. But he uses the word bloody, which is kind of English sounding, which is English.
That's exactly right, yeah.
But, you know, they might have been talking like that. So, that's one thing. And then when he talks about the girls making lace, I found that I liked when he said that this, if a soldier in France buys chocolate or a pair of stockings, he agrees that they shouldn't listen to the complaints of the French population, who are saying that the Germans are buying up all our stuff, because they still could buy their stuff too, you know. Boy, that brings to mind Leopold Wenger's long time stay in France as a pilot, and all the various times he talked about shopping for his mother, you know, and looking for, and he would send chocolate, but he was looking. One time he bought a big bottle, I guess, of French vanilla, and then he bought material and so on so she sold things and so she could make some dresses. And he was doing that a lot. And with all these German soldiers in France at the time, they had money, and they were buying goods and sending them home to Germany to their wives and mothers. And I guess the French were complaining, and Hitler says, heck with that. Let them buy whatever they want. What do we care?
Sure. Well, you know, if my memory is correct, in our studies of this book, at some point, some time ago, I thought I remembered that when the German soldiers went into France like that and occupied, they had beaten France, that they had orders not to buy things from the French, and don't do this. And Gehrig really was upset about that and said, hey, you know, why deprive these guys? If they want to buy a nice present and send it home, stop this Mickey Mouse rules about them not being able to purchase. You don't want them buying things from the French, you know, putting money in a Frenchman's pocket. He said, use some common sense. I thought I remembered something like that.
Wow, well, you must have remembered it from somewhere. I don't remember it, but he mentions the Reichsmarshal here, so that's it. I'm sure that's right. That's interesting.
August the 4th, 1942, evening. American military courts in Britain. Invasion from the West. Speaking to Dr. Dietrich, the Fuhrer said, if I were you, I should treat this business, the introduction of American courts of law for American soldiers in Britain, in the following way. The Turks have abolished extraterritoriality, and Britain has stepped into Turkey's shoes. Swift decline of Britain to a second-class power. They can only make a landing in the West by throwing in the finest of their units. Nothing less has a hope of success. But that means staking their all on one card. As regards the air arm, their experts will probably say to themselves, Germany is in a position to increase her forces at will and with lightning speed, and to attack in three or four places at the same time. We simply haven't the requisite forces. I think that the soldiers will fight tooth and nail to avoid having to shoulder the responsibility, particularly as they well know how cautious the politicians can be. So the generals write memoranda to show that the thing is not possible. The politicians retort that, on the other hand, only operations conceived on the largest possible scale stand a chance of success. But they will say so in a way which will permit them, in case of failure, to turn around and exclaim, "There, what did I tell you?" And the soldiers' own reply can be, "There's no going back now. If things go wrong, all is lost." Even so, think of the declaration of war in 1939. They had no armaments at all, and yet they declared war. In those days, they had, I believe, 6 divisions. It's quite possible that they will again let themselves be hoodwinked by fairy tales from the emigres. The soldiers, I know, were against war, but there are people over there who don't give a damn if Britain does collapse. Yes, I mean the Jews. There are others who say, if the Russians are beaten, then we shall be the war criminals. There will be trials, and we shall end up in the Tower. The soldiers will defend themselves by saying that they had given full warnings of the danger Britain ran in accepting the risk of undertaking an invasion. But for the politicians who declared war and the Jews who drove them to it, there is no defense. And these latter are quite capable of risking a second attempt. On the other hand, they may say to themselves, we're taking on an opponent who has so far knocked the teeth out of everybody who has opposed him. In 1940, they had beside them 138 French divisions, 18 Dutch, and 33 or 34 Belgian divisions. With the 10 divisions or so at their disposal now, they can do nothing. If, thanks to the measures we are now taking, we can succeed in increasing their reluctance to face so great an enterprise, so much the better. By next spring, the buildup of our fortifications will have reached a point where even an attack against one of our submarine bases will be out of the question. Little by little, the Atlantic Wall is acquiring all the characteristics of the West Wall. I can well imagine the furious activity behind the scenes of the opponents of Roosevelt.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. You want to say anything about it before I start?
Well, just that last line. He says, I can well imagine the furious activity behind the scenes of the opponents of Roosevelt. And there were those, even at this point, that were ticked off at Roosevelt for actually being in the war. The Americans were all head up by the Japanese. And I think there were some that were starting to question, sending boys into Europe because it was going to be a second front that was going to cost a lot of lives and things like this. And there were people that were certainly in opposition to FDR.
I thought that the opponents of Roosevelt, see, he saw that, maybe you were saying this and I didn't hear it. He saw that there was a lot of opposition to Roosevelt, and there was. And it would have succeeded except for the action of the Jews. It was the Jews with all their lobbying and their press, with their control of the press and so on, that kept that from. And in the legal world, they accused these people of treason and so on and started these trials. I think that the opposition to Roosevelt would have succeeded except for the Jews. And also, of course, we know that when Roosevelt managed to have the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor, then that ended it too. First I just thought we should clarify that Dr. Dietrich is Hitler's press spokesman. And was at the time, and he has some more to say to Dietrich here, and they got along very well. I'll also mention that Hattie Scott is still translating this long article, I guess it's long, I don't know, by Dietrich, Otto Dietrich, on race, which he's not going real fast, so he's just got the third part there, which he's only describing rather than giving a translation of, but it's still interesting, following along with table talk here. Again, for the politicians who declared war and the Jews who drove them to it, there is no defense. I don't know what this means that I wrote here, but against war crimes charges and blame for losing, there's no defense against, well, I would say that, yeah, the English were guilty of war crimes, and they would have been blamed for it if they had lost. I don't know. What did I write that there for? I don't remember what I was thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, he's saying the actual declaring of war by the politicians and the Jews that drove them to it, there's no defending that position. There's no excuse you can say, well, the British needed to declare war to protect Poland's interest or whatever their phony-ass reason was. But as Hitler correctly says, there is no defense for these politicians who did the bidding of the Jews and declared war against Germany. And there's no defendable position there because Germany was no threat to England except as an economic power, and that's the one thing that England couldn't stand. And so,
yeah. And you know, they were thinking all along that people would recognize these things, and that in the end, you know, this truth would be clear that they didn't have any defense for what they were doing, but he didn't. Who did understand the extent to which the Jews are able to go and drive the their allied puppets to go and to blame it all on Germany? He had no concept at this time that they could have ever done what they did by the time of the end of the war. And it was Himmler who just recognized it very late when he said they're putting together a case against us because of the concentration camps, and they're going to hang us all by that. He recognized what was going on. Oh, okay. Well, I thought that was really good. What he was saying there. So now we go on. Oh, this is a good
one. 5th of August, 1942, midday. Importance of food supply. The rascally clan of chefs. The gluttony of the Swiss, the heroic period of German colonization, the experiences of the Prince von Ehrenberg. The number of courses served at an official banquet is monstrous. I think there is something rather degrading in laying such store by food. And the most disagreeable feature is that these banquets always last for hours, and one always sits next to someone with whom one has nothing in common. My own particular tragedy is that, as head of the state, I always have the most worthy ladies as my dinner partners. I'd far rather go on board the Robert Lay and pick out some pretty little typist or sales girl as my partner. The whole of this banquet business is a racket invented by that rascally band, the Cooks. These kings of the cooking pots are all ridiculous idiots, mesmerizing the people and intoxicating themselves with a mass of meaningless phrases and obscure names which no one understands in the least. Where is the good old one-dish meal, Eintopf, of the past? Nothing so vulgar exists anymore. It's disappeared like the good old honest soup. It is all so beautifully mixed, food and phraseology, that nowadays one has not the faintest idea what one is eating. It was the same thing before the war. Every festive occasion demanded a 12-course banquet. In 1923, I was in Switzerland, and I remember a meal in Zurich at which the number of courses completely flabbergasted me. What sort of mentality has this little people, pray? In Austria, we have now acquired mountain country of such wonderful beauty that no one will dream of going to Switzerland until the Swiss themselves crawl on their knees and beg to be taken under the wing of the Third Reich. Turning to Dr. Dietrich, it seems from reading their press that the Swiss have become a little less bombastic. They are a little less contemptible than before. They attained the depth of ignominy at the time of our occupation of Yugoslavia. Now, they thought, we have had it. And they exposed all the pettiness of their miserable little souls. Thieves, robbers of other people's lands, they shrieked at our frontier guards. I was quite astonished recently at the amount of drink the Finns put away. It seems that the further north one goes, the more drink people can carry. Aden, I suppose, is the most infernal heat cauldron on Earth. I have quite made up my mind that nothing will induce me to travel through the Red Sea. I should die of heart failure. Prince Ehrenberg, one of our earliest adherents, has told me many interesting tales of pioneering days in our colonies. He was once sentenced to 12 years penal servitude and served 6 of them for having killed a nigger who had attacked him. The answer to people who asserted that we were not good colonizers, he said, was that with the methods we tried to employ, we could not get any colonies at all. And his opinion was based on a very considerable amount of thought. Ehrenberg used to drive one of the oldest Benz cars I have ever seen. And in it, he once insisted on driving me to Kempton when I was on my way to Switzerland. On the level, the old car ran reasonably well, but at the slightest sign of a hill, it blew its head off, and we were in grave danger of sticking fast. He had to change gears all the time, and so we trundled along hour after hour. At last, we came to the downhill part of the journey, and there the car flew along at least 30 miles an hour. And the man was a multimillionaire, but in this respect, he was as obstinate as a mule. In the East, it will be all over once we have cut their communications to the South and to Murmansk. Without oil, they are finished. In the West, it will be all over when once we are able to transfer even half of our forces to France. And that we shall be able to do as soon as we have smashed the armament and food-producing centers in Russia. He runs a gamut there of a lot of things.
Go ahead, but I saw, just before you say that, I want to mention that this is an example of Haim, where he just picks out what he thinks is important in what the Fuhrer is saying, and he puts that down, and he doesn't have any connection from one, you know, when he changes subjects. And it's kind of difficult.
That's exactly right.
And Picker somehow did that, you know. Somehow he let us know that things were changing. I find this a little disconcerting at times. If we just read it straight through.
Right, right. And initially, it's evident that he's talking about all these banquets and these 12-course meals and things like that and how phony it is, you know, and all these magnificent dishes that these chefs dream up and things like this. And to a man of the people, it was so much pretentiousness and probably waste, too, that he just shook his head at it and thought, wow, this is phony as it can be.
He also didn't like eating all those different things at the same time.
Right.
And I think it's interesting that he even brings up the one-dish meal, which is really, you know, kind of peasanty-like. But I love one-dish meals. I do it as much as I can. I like to put everything in one pot and eat it, and I don't like a lot of stuff, different stuff either. I like to eat pretty much one or two things, and that's it, you know, at a given time. But I know that not everybody's like that. But I have that in common with Hitler, so it wasn't so unusual to actually sincerely prefer that. And he didn't prefer those banquets with all the courses. But at the same time, he brings in Switzerland, and he's put down Switzerland before. I shouldn't say put down, but you know, he doesn't have a high opinion of the Swiss or of Switzerland. And he says, what kind of Germans are these who live there? they're not the Germans he likes or he thinks well of. And so he's doing it again here and putting it all together. Of course, Switzerland is known for all its hotels, and it's got some of the most famous hotels because of so much tourism there, because of the landscape. And he's saying that, well, with Austria, now we can all go there. Nobody has to go to Switzerland to see the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, what about Dr. Dietrich? Well, he doesn't say really anything to him, but he just talked to him.
That's right. That's all that's described as.
Yeah. He says the Finns put a lot. I think it's funny. I can just hear him saying that. I was quite astonished recently at the amount of drink the Finns put away. But, you know, he doesn't drink at all. So he's with all these people and then drinking away, and he's like, wow, look at all this booze they put down. I would say something about Prince Ehrenberg. I looked him up, you know, I wanted to find a picture of him to put on the on the Blog Talk slideshow picture display, and I couldn't find anything. I read about his ancestors, and the family goes back, way back, very old. But they must have been put out of business by the time he came along, and they weren't. He still carried the name Prince, but I don't think he had anything to be a prince over. And he joined the National Socialists, but there isn't even a photograph. I found a photograph, maybe of his father, but not of him. But it's funny to hear Hitler talk about him, saying he seemed to be, that's what I wanted to say. In this part here, where he said that Ehrenberg had to serve 6 years in the colonies for having killed a nigger. That's what Hitler said. Used that word.
Yes.
And for people who just recently, I don't know if you've got caught wind of it, too much of it, but are going on about, I brought up Veronica Clark again for reasons but came up, and who thinks that these blacks were so welcome in Germany and so on. And now Fritz Berg, the revisionist, is saying the same thing simply to back up Veronica Clark. It's ridiculous. Now, here's a good example of it. What the kind of language he uses. He used it here. He doesn't always say that. He sometimes, we find him saying, what does he say? Negro? Has he said Negro at times or whatever? But if it's translated like this, it was copied down like this by the note taker. That's because that's what he said. Not that I want to be vulgar, but I do want to point this out, that I'm just, because I'm fed up with people who want to change Hitler's views into some tolerant person who is tolerating all the races in Germany. I have a timeline, and if we're ready to go on, timeline for the 5th, the U.S. planning team for Operation Torch, which includes George Patton, Jimmy Doolittle, Kent Lambert, and Hoyt S. Vandenberg, meets in Washington, D.C. to join the combined planning team from London, England. So this Operation Torch took place further on in November. Right now it's August, but they just met for their first big meeting about it. And I'll just say quickly that Operation Torch was initially called Operation Gymnast, and it was the British-American invasion of French North Africa, which started, on 8 November 1942. The Soviet Union had pressed the United States and United Kingdom to start operations in Europe and open a second front to reduce the pressure of German forces on the Soviet troops. While the American commanders favored Operation Sledgehammer, which was an actual landing in Europe, as soon as possible, the British commanders believed that such a course would end in disaster, so they compromised on North Africa landing. It was tough, but they did have eventual success there, but that's enough for now because they're only now in the planning stage. The thing is that stands out to me is that the Soviet Union is not having an easy time, and the Germans probably, if there hadn't been that landing in Normandy, the Germans might have defeated the Soviet Union if they had been free to. Not so much attention elsewhere, because when they did do the landing in North Africa, they had to divert all kinds of troops down there. And even that was difficult, too. But without that second front, and that was another front down there in North Africa for the Germans, they were worried. So when they brag today that, we defeated those Germans without any help from anybody, bull. Not true.
That's right.
Yeah.
Very true. Okay, 5th of August, 1942, evening. Special guest, Field Marshal Kesselring. Balbo's tragic death. National Socialism and Fascism. The disadvantages of monarchy. Britain commands respect. The Italians are first-class colonizers. Given 10 years of Italian rule, Addis Ababa would have become a most beautiful city. The death of Balbo was a great tragedy. There was a worthy successor of the Duce, a man who had something of the condottieri of the Renaissance in him, a man whose name alone was worth something. I must admit that the Italians infuriate me with their continual running away. but purely from the point of view of a world philosophy, they are the only people on Earth with whom we can see eye to eye. When I read the history of fascism, I feel as if I'm reading the history of our movement. The same cowardly and lazy bourgeoisie, which believed in nothing, avoided any sort of conflict, and lived in perpetual fear of irritating the Reds. The first time I wished to go to Ingolstadt, I was told it was 15 years since a meeting of such a nature had been held there, and that the proletariat would certainly regard it as an act of provocation. The main difference between Italy and Germany is that in the former, the Duce has not been made the supreme dictator of the state. As a result, there are always ways and means of circumventing his orders. If, for example, he calls for a particularly valiant effort, the corps of officers immediately appeals to the king. Such a state of affairs must be maddening to a man of the Duce's personality. But I must, however, quite frankly confess that in 1920, if the monarchy had been restored after the Kapp Putsch, we should have supported it. It was only later that we gradually realized that a monarchy had outlived its time. Schoenerer is the only one who attacked the monarchy, and with unparalleled mercilessness. But his attack was directed against the House of Habsburg, and this did not prevent him from supporting the House of Prussia. The Duce dare not absent himself very long from Rome. If he does, that nest of intrigue immediately sets to work. Balbo had the great advantage that he had equal influence with both party and armed forces, and it is an ironic fate that he should have been shot down by Italian anti-aircraft guns. As long as ships sail, aircraft fly, and soldiers march, the problem of the ideal form of command will continue to exist. Should one have one centralized, unified command, or should the various services of the armed forces each have its own separate command organization? In many cases, a sole, unified command is preferable. We shall only have complete control of Norway when the railway reaches Kirkenes. In North Africa, the British were incredibly stupid. They never for a moment believed that the Italians would gain possession of their railway system. If we wish to deal them a real low blow, we ought to spread the rumor that Rommel postponed his offensive until the British had completed the construction of their line as far as Tobruk. We must, at all costs, advance into the plains of Mesopotamia and take the Mosul oil fields from the British. If we succeed here, the whole war will come to an end, for the British have now only Haifa as their sole loading port for oil. As regards oil, statistics show that the Russians, until quite recently, obtained 92% of their oil from the Caucasus. The people in the vicinity of these headquarters are all excellently nourished. I cannot help feeling that the Soviet state is being completely hoodwinked by the peasants, in spite of its most strenuous efforts. But conditions in the Ural districts and in Siberia must be terrible, as they must be also in the big cities. Let us hope that our Ministry for Eastern Territories will not, in conjunction with the Ministry of the Interior, introduce here our laws against contraception. There are plenty of other things with which our busybody officials can occupy their time, and thank God I shall not live to see them at it. If I did, I might regret ever having captured the country. In this respect, the British are our superiors. They, too, are the most frightful bureaucrats, but at least they have the sense not to exercise their bureaucracy in occupied territory to the advantage of the local inhabitant and the detriment of their own country. They have a genius for keeping others at a distance and in winning and preserving respect. Here, perhaps, we have the worst possible example of our methods. Delousing infuriates the local inhabitants, as does our fanatical desire to civilize them. The net result is that they say to themselves, these people aren't really our superiors. It's only the way they're made.
Well, there's a little bit of that occupation stuff again, and why he thinks that they shouldn't be trying to bring the people up to their level. That the British don't do it, and he thinks they're right in that, and they need to learn something from the British in this respect. And why are the British never criticized for that? But the Germans are criticized so much for just talking about it, even though they never even got to carry it out.
Right.
That's because they're talking about what people say are white people, and the British were not dealing with white people. That's why these people have that feeling, seems to me. Oh, and I thought I'd say that this town, Ingolstadt, that he mentioned, is a very well-known city in Bavaria and very touristically, very attractive place. When he mentions Schirnerer, he was an Austrian. I don't know if he was the mayor, one of the mayors, or just a politician down there, because there's two Austrians that were nationalists, pretty much, that Hitler has talked about quite a lot in the past. But he's, what else does he say here?
Well, there's one little tip-off of what's to come regarding Mussolini, and that is, of course, that since he hasn't been declared the supreme ruler or head of the dictator of the state, there will always be a ways and means of circumventing his orders because there's the monarchy, you know, that the people feel like, well, Mussolini, he's a powerful politician and everything, but if we don't like what he wants to do or is doing, then we can turn to the monarchy to do something about it. And this intrigue going on behind Mussolini's back is what will eventually overwhelm him and cost him his life. But I was just going to say that he mentions people living in perpetual fear of irritating the Reds, you know, and stuff like that. So, it was just a shame for Mussolini that he didn't have the total authority like Hitler had in his government.
Well, Hitler always said that and always told him that. But actually, Mussolini would say, oh, don't worry, I've got all that covered. Well, he didn't, you know.
Yes.
But
right.
He had this confidence. He went a lot by confidence. But he didn't have the people behind him to make it go his way. As Hitler says, we think so much alike, the Italians. I have a great fondness for Italians, too, but I agree, you know, that you can get real irritated by their constant running away. They're not able to stick with things the way the Germans do. So everybody is so, there's so many differences among the peoples, so many differences. Well, okay, shall we go on?
Okay, let's go on to the 6th of August, 1942, midday. The grandeur of the open spaces. Flemish and Dutch peasants. Ukrainian markets. How small Germany looks from here. The British and the Russians possess that self-assurance which is born of vast spaces. I hope that in time we too shall acquire it. Somebody ought immediately to write a book, The Ideal State of the Future, a problem of diet and education. And in it, one should advocate that the citizen should be fed on grass in order to increase his docility and amenity to discipline. It is a fact that tuberculosis is more prevalent among cattle kept in stables than in cattle out at pasture. In my part of the world, the peasants maintain that big windows and plenty of light reduce the milk output. In North Germany, where the cattle live almost entirely in the open, there's practically no tuberculosis at all. In wooded territories, on the other hand, the cattle are kept in stalls throughout almost the whole year, and it is only recently that the veterinary surgeons have realized how dangerous that can be. Most of the properties there are so small that they cannot afford to keep oxen and harness their cows to the carts. In Germany, we have some districts which are deplorable. Part of the Bavarian forest land, the western part of the Hessian mountains, the Waldviertel, and parts of the Swabian Alb. The life of the peasants in these territories is a real hell on earth. If all the work and endeavor used there could be applied to this part of the world, we should increase production five times over. When I was quite a kid, ein Bub, the whole of my homeland was strewn with boulders. It must originally have been at the bottom of a glacier into which the rocks of the moraines were thrust. Gradually, the peasants blasted the rock masses away, but the same conditions continue all the way down to Lower Austria, and somehow it makes the landscape seem very friendly and attractive. In the German Reich, we have only one district that can compare with the Ukraine, the Moravian plains northward from Vienna, eastwards from Brunn, and southeasters from Olmutz, and that is a land of unbelievable fertility. One of the things which astonished me most at the beginning of the First War was the amazing industriousness of the Flemish farmer. You would hardly credit the things I saw. Nothing is wasted. When a mounted column passed through, the children would be on the alert, and the moment it had passed, out they would come and pounce on any manure that might have fallen. Every square yard is utilized at the utmost, exactly as in Holland. There is, however, a dangerous side to this tendency. Such people are apt to lose the broad view, which, after all, is the most important. The man who possesses with the wide spaces must show himself to be the master of the others, even if he restricts his activities to the colonization of his own country. When the rest of the world was engaged in seizing the open spaces, Germany was in the throes of religious warfare. The foundation of St.
Now he's going on to another subject, so to speak. And so I want to make a few comments here because they won't mean too much if I wait. You know, it's clear that he's at the headquarters in Ukraine. And when he talks about how Germany looks small from here, because he sees Ukraine is such a vast area and so open and so on. And he just loves that. Boy, it's just drawn him and pulled him from a long time back. He's wanted to get into Ukraine. And he likes it, and he's appreciating these vast spaces. And I can understand that, too, because I discovered at some point that I'm really made for wide open spaces, and I don't like closed spaces if I can do differently. But I grew up in a wide open, I grew up in town, but, you know, in a wide open area, the Illinois Corn Belt. And I always thought that because that's the general thing, that it wasn't interesting. You know, it was so boring. I thought, what a boring place where I live. And when I moved back there for a while as an adult, I got such great happiness from looking off into the distance in certain places where, you know, if you're outside of town and so on, and how the far horizon and all. It just actually I don't know if it exalted me, but it was like so pleasing. And I realized that I was more made for that and what I had grown up with. There's so many things in my life when I criticized, didn't appreciate what I had when I was young, you know, thought something else had to be much better. That was my problem. I had everything perfect, really. I had a wonderful situation. But anyway, he's really enjoying that, and that they are in Ukraine here, and what he's saying is kind of referring to that. And also the Vol Viertel, that you mentioned when he mentioned these different areas in German areas. That's the area he comes from, in Lower Austria there, close to Germany. So he's talking about his own districts where he grew up as being deplorable, you know, deplorable for the people who live there. And he's going to talk more, I think, about how bad life can be for some of the peasants. Sometimes it's good, and in other places it's not good. The peasantry. Okay, I think that's about it.
Okay. When the rest of the world was engaged in seizing the open spaces, Germany was in the throes of religious warfare. The foundation of St. Petersburg by Peter the Great was a fatal event in the history of Europe, and St. Petersburg must therefore disappear utterly from the earth's surface. Moscow, too. Then the Russians will retire into Siberia. It is not by taking over the miserable Russian hovels that we shall establish ourselves as masters in the East. The German colonies must be organized on an altogether higher plane. We have never before driven forward into empty spaces. The German people have absorbed both northern and southern Austria, and the original inhabitants are still there. But they were Sorb Winds, members of basic European stock, with nothing in common with the Slavs. As for the ridiculous 100 million Slavs, we will mold the best of them to the shape that suits us, and we will isolate the rest of them in their own pigsties. And anyone who talks about cherishing the local inhabitant and civilizing him goes straight off into a concentration camp. At harvest time, we will set up markets at all these centers of any importance. There, we will buy up all the cereals and fruit and sell the more trashy products of our own manufacture. In this way, we shall receive for these goods of ours a return considerably greater than their intrinsic value. The profit will be pocketed by the Reich to defray the price of the campaign. Our agricultural machinery factories, our transportation companies, our manufacturers of household goods, and so forth, will find there an enormous market for their goods. It will also be a splendid market for cheap cotton goods. The more brightly colored, the better. Why should we thwart the longing of these people for bright colors? My one fear is that the Ministry for Eastern Territories will try to civilize the Ukrainian women. These girls, bursting with health, would introduce a welcome strain into the race, for many of them are obviously of sound Germanic origin. Otherwise, whence the fair blue-eyed children? The best among them we will gradually assimilate and take into the Reich. The rest can remain here.
Well, what do you have to say about that?
Well, that's a pretty in-depth analysis of colonization and following the British example of don't patronize the people with whom you've taken rule over and make, you know, try to make them into what you are. And, you know, that's he's saying, hey, leave them be. We're not after the hovels and not going to take them over and try to make something out of them. We're going to put up German colonies there and leave these people to their own business. And because he has spoken that that's how the Brits have been successful in their colonization.
Well, you know, when he said anyone who talks about cherishing the local inhabitants and civilizing him, or an inhabitant and civilizing him, goes straight off into a concentration camp. Well, he's just making a point there. So that's one thing. When he says St. Petersburg has to be destroyed and also Moscow. And he was serious about that, which has also upset people. And, you know, I've heard him say that before about St. Petersburg and also Moscow, but I didn't really understand why. But he talks about it further on, which I don't think we're going to get to tonight, but he talks about it a little bit more. And part of it was that, I think, from what he said later, that they were too close to the Baltic states and to Finland and so on. St. Petersburg is right there. And he doesn't think a great Russian city should be so close. I think that's the problem with it. So it had to go, the whole city. He was going to destroy it. That's what he wanted to do. And get he wanted the people, when that siege was going on, he wanted the people to leave and go off east into Russia somewhere. But the Russians or the Soviets said, no, you're all going to stay there. And they insisted everybody stay, and they sent more people there to fight, and they held on there. And there was all this death. I don't know how many people died from lack of food and everything else there. But the Germans felt, it's not our problem. We want to conquer this city. Yeah, this is war, and they wouldn't allow it to happen. So they really, in a sense, the Soviets allowed their own people, that many Russians, to die, which we know they didn't care too much about that. So when I think that with Moscow, it was a few other things, which maybe we can talk about when we get to it, because I can't really think of how to talk about it now. But it was also quite close to Europe there, and so Hitler thought that had to go too. Those cities had to go, and then they could continue to move on. They couldn't leave them there. And symbolically, too, for Moscow, and maybe St. Petersburg, too, because it was founded by Peter the Great. So maybe symbolically he thought they had to go. It sounds this is a very harsh. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, I was just going to say, some of the thought had to be that they saw Moscow as the head of the Bolshevik snake.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, the big push.
The Kremlin and all.
Yes. The big push into Germany a couple of years past where we are right now. You know, the whole goal was capture Berlin, because that's the head of the National Socialist government. That's where they are. And I think it was kind of related to his talking about Moscow had to be destroyed. I think that played a part in it, too.
Well, you always wanted to take the
capital
city. And then you don't want to just move into it. You want to actually destroy it because it has too much symbolical value for the people.
That's true.
There
right.
And all that. But anyway, he's making it. He's saying straight out here about these two cities, what he wants
right.
to do with them.
Right.
Oh.
6 August 1942 evening. Income tax
well,
and the
peasants. Let me make a quick. I'm sorry,
yeah,
Ray.
Sure.
Let me make a quick comment about this last paragraph. You know, when I first read it, I thought, well, I understand what he's saying, but I thought this is sexist. You know, and not that I mind. Mm-hmm. I'm being sexist, but it is sexist because he's saying that we want some of these women, but they're not going to take the men. They don't want to take the men. Then I thought about it more when I was thinking about talking about it, and I thought, well. Now, you know, I think he took this word for word from Bormann, what Bormann said about his tour that he took through Ukraine. A couple weeks ago, we talked about that. It wasn't that long ago, though, just a few days ago, maybe, in real time. And he said the adults were bursting with health. So Hitler's using that phrase now. And he, you know, again, Hitler uses the word girls. I don't know what that is in German, but, you know, he even when women get to... Even his secretaries and so on, he would call them the girls and so on.
Yeah.
And I don't take offense at that either. I don't have that feeling.
Right.
I'm not a feminist like that, which is, you know, to be offended by everything. And, in fact, I like the word girls because I think they go too far in correcting political correctness by calling even, say, a 15-year-old girl a woman. You know, in the news and so on, and that bothers me when they call such young women a woman because they're not a woman, but they don't want to use the word girl because that's just totally politically incorrect now. So in any case, I thought, well, they would take the Ukrainian men. Ukrainian men will have these political and nationalist ideas. And even though they might go along with the Germans for a while and all, that those ideas can always take root and they can be plotting against the Germans. But the women wouldn't if they were young enough. And then he likes the fact that they're very have lots of children
right.
And they're blonde and blue-eyed and all, and they fit right in. And so you could take these women in and improve the race and add to the race and add to their population. And it wouldn't be a problem further on because they wouldn't get political about it. And I think that's what he's. I figured out that that's what he was going by, and makes a lot of sense. So I took back my idea that it was sexist.
Yeah. All right. Okay. 6 August 1942 evening. Income tax and the peasant. Taxation in kind. The peasant and the beauties of nature. Our peasants always lack ready money because the ground at their disposal is too small for their needs. I've often wondered whether it would not be a good idea to reintroduce some sort of tithe system under which the peasant could pay his taxes in kind. As things are, the middleman gets for his potatoes, for instance, 3 or 4 times what he pays the peasant for them. It would therefore be to the peasant's advantage to be able to pay his taxes in potatoes rather than money. The advantages accruing to the state would counteract the loss of revenue from taxation. In most professions, income can be judged in terms of money, but this does not hold in the case of the small farmer. German agriculture will benefit greatly if we introduce new regulations to govern farming based on the potential revenue of the property. In Württemberg and Baden, the situation is particularly bad. As a result of the never-ending process of division among heirs, the properties are becoming smaller and smaller. I shall not mind at all if I'm compelled to eject 4,000 or 5,000 peasants from Alsace. I can replace them with the greatest ease with men from Baden and Württemberg. In the Middle Ages, a hide of land sufficed. But now the introduction of the triple crop system demands much more space. Our country today is overpopulated, and the numbers immigrating to America are incredible. How I wish we had the German Americans with us still. Insofar as there are any decent people in America, they are all of German origin. In Britain, they have the sound law that only the eldest son of a peer can inherit the title. In our country, we have nobles by the score who cannot make a living and who will not die. This calls for reform in the future. The whole social structure of the state must be built up on cold, logical lines. Once we are in a position to start colonizing the East, most of our difficulties will disappear. When the first few hundred are comfortably settled, the rest will soon follow. It is the earth that attracts the peasant. Several hundreds of thousands have immigrated from Salzburg and Upper Austria to East Prussia. It is only in the pictures of the court artists that one sees peasants gazing at the stars in heaven. The real peasant keeps his eye firmly on the land, and he lives by the plow. The beauties of the woods were discovered not by the peasant, but by the professor. Wherever good quality land is to be found, there one also finds the best type of peasant. It is not, however, the good earth that has improved the peasant stock, but rather that the best type of peasant always finds and takes possession of the best land. The peasantry, therefore, is the solid backbone of the nation, for husbandry is the most chancy occupation on earth. What, think you, would happen if the work of a city worker or an official depended on chance? Work on the land is a schooling which teaches energy, self-confidence, and a readiness to make swift decisions. The town dweller, on the contrary, must have everything exactly mapped out for him and does all he can to eliminate the slightest chance of any risk. As a last resort, he takes out an insurance policy, and the insurance company which issues it to him reinsures itself into the bargain. France, which has 59% of its population on the land, is still fundamentally sound. It is a great tragedy when once a nation loses the solid foundation of its peasantry. The great British landowners have not the faintest idea of practical agriculture, quite apart from the time and money they waste on their celebrated lawns. The Italians have a splendid foundation of peasantry. Once, when I was traveling to Florence, I thought, as I passed through it, what a paradise this land of southern France is. But when I reached Italy, then I realized what a paradise on earth can really be. Herein lies one of the Duce's main sources of strength. He once said to me, "Fuhrer, thank goodness, only a very small percentage of my population are town dwellers." And I like this little section because it goes back to the basic thing that makes your nation solid, and that's the farmer. That's the people who risk. Like he says, husbandry, agriculture is such a roll-the-dice thing, and it makes people tougher and builds character. And he admits, hey, this is the very basis of what the strength of our country is, our peasantry. And I like that.
Yeah, you would, and it's like the working class, too, because, but we don't, you know, nowadays, we don't have a peasantry. Where is there a peasantry? Because agriculture has been taken over by industry.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
There are still independent farmers, and they're quite inspiring, really, and wonderful mm-hmm. to see. It still goes on, but so not yeah. like it was during his time. So they've just taken over everything, and they don't take any chances either. They've got things set up, like he says, with their insurance and so on. That's what insurance
right.
is, to take all the chances out of life so you don't have to worry about anything, which doesn't make for strong people who can deal with crises and so on. What else did he say here that you liked?
Well, the remark he made about France, which has 59% mm-hmm. of its population on the land, that means 6 out of 10 Frenchmen are small farmers and land people, so...
It's always been that way in France. The French
yeah.
really do like their land. France, for all the idea that we get, that it's about Paris and all these far, really...
Big cities.
big cities and kind of a
urban,
degenerate life, yeah, and urban. It really is a country, and it's very large because, you know, it's a very big space that France takes up. And so they have a lot of land, and they're just basically living on the land. They like that. And as you said, even city people keep, if they have enough money, they keep a place in the country. And they actually, you know, raise things there and so on. They don't just go there to lay around.
Right.
And then he mentions the Italians. And I liked where he said, because I could really relate to it, where he said that he thought when he went through southern France that this was really like paradise. But when he got to Italy, then he saw what paradise really was. And, you know, I remember so well when I was there and took a bus tour from Rome, where I spent most of my time, to Naples. And my, what a trip that was. Oh, my gosh, what beauty. It was all this hilly countryside with it was all farmed. But it was more like beautiful gardens on it because there were small areas. And it was just like perfectly, well, you can just see that that the people who were taking care of it, the farmers there or whatever you might call them, loved it, and that was their whole life. And they did it. They made everything so beautiful. But, of course, the climate and so on and the richness of the land because of the volcanoes that had taken place there and so on. There's a lot of volcanic land that was very, very fertile. And so it's just, you know, lemon trees, and there'd be some of this stuff and some of that stuff, and just absolutely works of art to my mind. And I was just blown away, and I loved it, loved seeing it all. So I know how beautiful Italy is. But if you're in the cities, then there's a lot of, if you pay attention, there's a lot of dirt and not kind of grime, even though it's full of monuments and so on, you know, famous monuments, but still. But not in the countryside.
That little section there, in fact, what you just said brought back a real memory to me, Carolyn. When I was in the ninth grade, in we called it junior high school then, I had, for one of my classes, the best teacher a student could ever hope to have. She was a young lady about maybe 28 to 30. Full of life, effervescent. Her dad was a playwright or a theater producer. She went to Europe one summer, and the next fall when she came back in her classes, I think it was, I asked her, you know, we were asking her, how was her trip? How'd she, she said it was wonderful, it was a great time. And what she told us was, what her biggest disappointment was, Paris. And generally France. She was very disappointed. She said it wasn't what I'd hoped I would find there. And we said, what was the best? And she said, hands down, Rome and Italy. Mm-hmm. And that, I thought of that when I read this right here, when Hitler said, you know, he thought it was good in France until he got into Italy and he saw really what it was. And she was effervescent in her praise of Italy and particularly of Rome and the people and the romantic ideal that was seemed to be alive there, and that Paris had unfortunately for her just been a rather crass urban center. But
and this
I thought
would have
that
been
when
Ray
1958.
Well.
Yep. 1957-58.
Well, you know, I was in these places, I think, both of them in the 70s, and I'm not, maybe later in Paris, but they Rome is far more impressive than Paris. To me, there's a whole lot more, you know, that just takes your breath away because it's so old and famous stuff, you know, and for an art lover.
Right.
But in Paris, I was happy to be there and happy to go to the Louvre and things like that. But there's not, you know, it's not so great. It really isn't.
Right.
I'd rather go to Berlin. Berlin is a very lively place. But when I was there, it was beautiful weather. Sometimes the weather has a lot to do with how much effect.
That's
I think
true.
Often it does. Has a lot to do with your impression of any particular famous city.
Right.
But, well, that was interesting. Anything else you want to say about this or about the whole show tonight before we close it down?
No.
I would just like to say that this, I thought this was very interesting, and I'm thinking that we're getting down to, we're getting to a time when there's maybe going to be, it's going to be different somewhat from what we've had already, because everybody's going to be in more stress and
yeah, somber mood.
You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, somber maybe. And I really am sorry that Picker is gone, but we're going to have to make the best of having Haim here and his tendency to just write down things and not say anything about them. But it's going to be interesting, and we've August 42. We've got a lot of big events coming up. That's probably going to be difficult for me to deal with. I don't know how it's going to be talked about in here. I haven't read ahead except this next little section I read, but
yeah.
It should be interesting, and we'll stick with it and hope all our listeners stick with it. We do have a lot of people downloading this show, Ray, and listening to it.
Good. I'm
glad
we do.
I guess we'll say goodnight then to everyone and ask you to come back next week.
Yeah, let's see. Now, you know, ironically, I think I heard you say that 19th was your sister's birthday.
Yes.
February, not today, February 19th.
Yes.
Today would have been my parents' 74th wedding anniversary. They got married February 19th, 1941.
Well, what do you know? Look at what a connection that is. I never forget people's birthdays. I forget so many other things now, but I don't forget birthdays. Okay, well, thanks a lot, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks to you too, Ray. And yeah, this has been Hitler's Table Talk, episode 47, and we'll be back with episode 48 next Thursday.